This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. 12% of Hamilton County's population suffers from a disability. Many are children. Today we're going to talk about the challenges and struggles parents face trying to care for their children and help them not to feel isolated. We'll also hear about the joy these children bring. Joining me are Advocacy and Dissemination Coordinator for the UC University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, Dr. Kara Ayer. She joins us on the phone. Executive Director of Starfire, Tim Vogt, and Starfire Board Member Kathleen Kale. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
For those of you that may not have ever heard of Starfire, I thought a good place to start, Tim, maybe would have you explain what that is.
Sure. We are an organization that's about 20 years old now, grew out of Campfire here in Cincinnati. And what I could tell you is what we were and what we are going toward. We used to be an organization, and still are to some extent, that takes groups of people with disabilities out around the city on outings. And over the last 5 years, we've been working toward getting to something that's a little more meaningful, which would be trying to discover each person's unique identity and then help them develop a network around that identity of other citizens who share that passion or interest. So we're really community builders now. We're neighborhood builders. We are connectors as opposed to thinking traditional caretaking role is what we used to do.
Dr. Ayers, I thought you could talk for us a little bit about how widespread the issues of children with special needs are and how many families perhaps are affected by that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the current rates are around 12%, so people with disabilities are the largest minority, and I don't think in terms of like a cultural variable, and that's the way that I often look at disability, I don't think that many people think of it in terms of that way, and so I also look at it from the lens of a family perspective. So families are impacted by disability, and that could look a number of different ways. So it might be two parents without disabilities that have a child with a disability. It might be parents with disabilities that have children with or without disabilities. And then kind of the ripples from that affect the community and the family at large. So we're talking about a large number of people, and probably every listener is impacted by someone in their life, if not their own family or extended family that has a disability. So it's really an issue that, can benefit everyone to learn about and to be more aware about.
Tell us about what you do at UC in relationship to developmental disabilities.
Sure. So here at UC USED, we are one of 67 university centers for excellence in developmental disabilities across the country. And Ohio is fortunate to actually have two. We have ours here seated. We're seated at Children's Hospital. And then there's another USED up at Nisonger with Ohio State University. So we do a number of things. We work with and on the behalf of individuals with disabilities and their families. And we really have four main core functions. So we work with collaborations with the community. We do some research. We disseminate information about disabilities. And we also do training here. And that's a key piece of our children's relationships, too. So we really try to kind of come out to different angles in terms of working with the community and even training medical professionals on disability issues. So we work on a wide number of issues with a lot of different people.
Kathleen, of course, you work with Starfire. Tell us how you got involved and what you do.
So, yes, I'm on the board of Starfire, and I've been on the board since the beginning of this year. So I'm familiar mostly with Starfire as it is today and the vision that it has for the future, which is why I agreed to be on the board. I'm actually, aside from doing a lot of different volunteer advocacy work in the community, I'm a parent of two children, one of whom has a disability. And that's how I came to Starfire via the community that I've entered into with my daughter. So I chose, when Tim approached me to be on the board, I decided to be on the board of Starfire specifically for what they see as the future. My daughter has always been mainstreamed. We went to Mercy Montessori here in Cincinnati. It's a very small school. and she was always just part of the classroom, and there was really nothing I had to do to help her to become inclusive. She was simply, I would go in and students would say to me, this is how Grace does it. Teachers would say, oh, let, you know, the kids manage everything well. They never saw her as different. They saw her as, this is how Grace does things. And that's how we were for up through seventh grade for Grace. So my evolution is a function of some really just happenstance choices we made in what schools we put Grace into. She experienced a wonderful inclusive environment, and Starfire going in the direction of having people with disabilities find their passions, find their qualities, and mesh them with people, ordinary citizens in the community, was much like what I had experienced with Grace and what I see as her future and her success in this community.
I'd like to step back a little bit, and Kathleen, if you'll allow, and talk about what it was like as a parent for you when your daughter was born. Did you immediately see the a challenge? Did you see it as just another parenting a situation parents has to deal with? I mean, I think there are some parents maybe that are just becoming in a situation where they have a child that may have a disability and not exactly knowing where to turn. How was that for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had to say I had one emotion, I was all over the gamut. When my daughter was born, it was clear something was up. And we had people come into the house shortly after she got home from the hospital, which was a few weeks after she was born. And my reaction was always, oh, it's fine. It's, you know, it's great. And my husband, at the meantime, it was clicking in with him. I was probably in some sort of denial mode, but he was recognizing, like, we didn't have this when Ben was born. No one came and spent this much time with us when Ben was born. Nobody was checking in as frequently. So he was more on the road of, oh my gosh, we have bigger challenges ahead of us. I was probably a little bit in denial. I just kept thinking, oh, she's doing great. She's home. Everything's fine. But then, you know, there were points in time where I was pretty emotional, like, what does my future hold? What does this mean? And we didn't have a diagnosis, which is not uncommon. I mean, there are many parents who give birth to a child and something appears to be out of the ordinary and they don't know what it is. It took us 4 months. That's pretty good. Some families have gone many years before they've gotten diagnoses, which is incredibly hard. We had to wait about 4 months for a diagnosis, and even once we got the I think when I got the diagnosis, that's when it was a little bit more maybe earth-shattering for me, because then it was real. Okay, here's something. We know what it is. And I went through the modes of what's life going to be like for Grace 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, et cetera. And like all parents, you worry about your kids, and now all of a sudden your child seems far, far more vulnerable to the world. And all the dreams that you had for this child go away. You know, as a parent, you really are grieving, in my opinion, the loss of all the dreams that you had for this child for a while. And then you start to realize that, wait a minute, there are other dreams and there are other things. And it's a journey, and it's a different journey for every parent. And I think that there are times when I still sit there saying, what's going to happen if Grace has no friends? What if, you know, and I've had those feelings intermittently throughout the path. I'm sure I'll have them continuously throughout her life. And it's sometimes two steps forward, one step back. But you really do get to the point where you say, okay, I have to take this a day at a time. And then you get a few years out and you look back and think, I'm so glad I took it a day at a time, because what you read about, what people tell you and warn you about, doesn't necessarily happen. And all the planning and worrying about something that may not come into effect, or may come into effect in a very different way for your child, it can be very paralyzing for you if you take that all on at once. So,
Dr. Ayers, what do you think? Is that the story that most parents go through?
I think it's there is no kind of majority of the story, because it's such an individual and a unique experience. I know for myself, I came into the community in a much different way just upon birth. So I have a disability, as does my husband. We have osteogenesis imperfecta. So this has been our experience. And, of course, there were still those moments of kind of realities, as Kathleen was mentioning, in terms of, like, when you enter different phases of your life and you have a recognition of, okay, how will my disability affect my employment? How will it affect housing? And those issues that we maybe don't encounter until later in life. And so especially when we're parenting kids with disabilities, you know, and I have a three-year-old, so I understand that it's very hard for me to picture my three-year-old looking for a job or finding her first apartment. But it's so important for parents of kids with disabilities to start with that planning so soon. So for me, you know, my perspective has always been different because of that. And, even this weekend, my husband and I were at the local chapter of Little People of America. They had their holiday party, and I was talking to some other parents, and they were sharing about how, you know, this was so unique for me when they had their child, because they said, you know, I never even knew that this diagnosis existed and I hadn't heard of it. So I can definitely empathize with that. And then, for our family, it's a different kind of unique experience, because we were very aware of different disabilities, and we have really enjoyed being immersed in the disability culture and the disability community. So we found that as a strength. And, even though our daughter does not have a disability, she's still very connected in terms of, you know, she had a great time at the party too. And so we try to keep those connections alive, as Tim mentioned. I think that's a huge strength of our community, that people sometimes don't know until they gain membership to it, in terms of that there are struggles and there are challenges. But so fortunate to have this community that you get to be a part of, with so many diverse people that, it's unlike other groups that you get together with in the community, where you all kind of share all these variables. We're really a diverse group of people that share the element of disability.
We're talking this afternoon about parenting children with the challenges, rather, and joys of parenting children with disabilities. And we will continue our discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100. Or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about raising children with disabilities. Joining me are Advocacy and Dissemination Coordinator for the University of Cincinnati, University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, Dr. Kara Eyre. She's joining us on the phone today. Executive Director of Starfire, Tim Vogt, and Starfire Board Member Kathleen Kale. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We've talked a little bit about just the very initial phases of what it's like when you find out your child may have a disability or there are concerns there. What, and Dr. Ayers, maybe you can address this first. Talk to us a little bit about what advice you have for parents and how to handle that. And maybe you can talk about your own life and what you advise others.
Definitely. I think the first step is getting connected. That's been kind of, I think, a common word in this afternoon. So I think finding the community, it's equally important, in my opinion, to find a strong and knowledgeable medical community, as it is to also make those social connections in terms of other parents and other family members and other adults with that disability. I think sometimes that piece is sometimes missed, and that it's excellent to hear from people that have already been where your child will go, you know. And so to make those numerous connections, and there are a number of organizations that can help you make those. I know that we here at USED can help you connect. Children's has it's a special needs directory that has a number of resources, including specific disability support groups. Some of those are online. Some of those, you know, meet occasionally in person. So I think that parents need to definitely do that research on the condition and the diagnosis, if they have one. As Kathleen mentioned, that's not always the case. But they also need to make those community connections, because that will be critical to get through the challenges and to also, you know, get to enjoy the positive and the joyful part of our community.
Tim, talk about what you offer at Starfire there in the same way.
Sure. Just to kind of go back a second, when Dr. Ayers said this is a unique experience for each person and family, and that's very true. But what we've kind of discovered or learned from some really great thinkers in this work is that there are some timeless and universal things that help. You know, and those things are kind of old-fashioned, you know, friendships, neighbors, churches and memberships, belonging, just a sense that I'm a member of this, just like everyone else, despite what people see as different or wrong, maybe, about me. It's not really that way. It's just who I am. So what we've kind of noticed is that these services that people need, and they are very important services, provided by the government or by nonprofits, they're really great, but to some degree, we can over-rely on them, and we have to remember that our primary call as a community, as parents and families, is to build this really nice, strong, deep-rooted set of relationships with the people that live around us, start to figure out how we really support a person. So it's not just, to use Starfire as an example, what we used to do is we used to plan a big calendar with outings all over the city, and people would go with another four people with disabilities, and they got to eat. And then 2 hours later, they'd be done, you know, and they'd go home. And while that was all nice and it was fun, there wasn't a lot of long-term meaning coming from that. And when we had to face up to that, we really, it was a hard moment as an organization, and still is. There are difficult days. But what we realized was that you can use the same time that you would go out to eat with a group of people with disabilities, and you could also use that time to go out to eat with a group of neighbors or a group of people from church. So it's funny, there's this term called early intervention, where we would, you know, as you would experience, Kathleen, I mean, they came in right away and helped you know the technical things or the diagnoses, medical kind of things. Those are really important. And we talk about alternative early intervention, you know, join a church right away, go to everything on that bulletin for the next 50 years. Every neighbor that moves in, bake them cookies and welcome them to the neighborhood. Because when it comes to the big issues facing a lot of people, especially with intellectual disabilities that I know, things like Down syndrome, autism, they face an extreme social isolation that leads to a very high unemployment rate, a real lack of social connections, and it all kind of comes back to this network that's very, limited to just paid professionals in the service field and just other people with disabilities who are also being served in the service field. So while that's an important resource for a lot of people and families, there's another side to the work, and that's what we're trying to address.
What advice do you have for people in the general population to help them feel more comfortable? I think a lot of times that socialization, as you talk about, people are afraid, not necessarily afraid of the person, but afraid they're going to say the wrong thing, or afraid they don't know what to do, or just afraid that they just are afraid to approach it because they've never been around anyone who has a disability.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I think my daughter sometimes faces, is making people comfortable with asking her a question, you know. Instead of, you know, she'll say to me, I really don't like when people stare at my braces or stare at my wheelchair or what have you. And it's that barrier, that kind of invisible barrier that exists. What would be wrong with saying, why do you wear braces, or why are you in a wheelchair? And I love kids for that fact, because kids are not encumbered by what's politically correct, and they ask these great questions. But as adults, we become so afraid of what's politically correct. And I think if people can get beyond worrying about that and maybe understand the most fundamental needs that everybody has is shared, you know, I always talk about our shared humanity. It's really true. It is our shared humanity. my daughter wants friends. She wants to be invited to parties. She wants someone to call her up and go to the mall with. She wants all the same things that other 14-year-old girls want. And it's that humanity that we all share, regardless of ability, disability, whatever you want to call it. That's the important thing that everyone has to remember. And if people could just stop for a second and not worry about what was politically correct and think about the fact that what we all share are these basic needs for friendship, community, love, support, etc. And I think that could help people to cross that barrier and ask her some questions and get to know a person. That would be my advice.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that when these questions come up, I think when in doubt, engaging is always a preferred choice. And that comes both from me as a person with a disability and also me as a professional in looking at, you know, how we could grow as a community at large. And I also agree that kids are excellent at kind of pushing aside their parents who are saying, like, no, you know, trying to pull them away and saying, like, no, you know, I really want to ask you this. And from the perspective of kids with disabilities, I think it is a phenomenal opportunity for them to start to build their self-advocacy skills and to really learn how to phrase what makes them comfortable. So when you ask that question that comes up hundreds of times in the life of a person that uses a wheelchair in terms of, you know, it's asked a number of different ways. Why are you in that? What is that thing? What's wrong with you? To empower a child with a disability to find the answer that fits for them. And as a young child, of course, they often need support for that. And depending on their disability, they may need more or less support. But, you know, I also empower young adults and adolescents with disabilities who sometimes, to be honest, it does become tiresome. You know, there are times that as an adult, I do just want to run in and get a gallon of milk and not explain my medical history to someone. But so I do empower not only the young, you know, the adolescents with disabilities, but also their parents to realize that we can't be perfect educators all the time. We do have a right sometimes to run in and get that gallon of milk. So I know I kind of in my tool belt have a number of different answers. You know, I try my best to make as much time as I can to answer all questions in whatever depth that people want, you know, when they're asked in a respectful way. But I also empower other families to know that that it's okay that you get frustrated and that sometimes people, you know, outside the realm of political correctness, I think the root of that is just kind of general respect and common decency. And I think sometimes families of kids with disabilities feel like they don't have a right sometimes to be frustrated with questions or with stares. And that's really just part of the human experience, too. And the same way that we want that acceptance and that inclusion, sometimes we get frustrated, too, which is, you know, why it's great to have the support of others who understand that.
Let's talk about support. I think parenting is hard no matter what. Parenting, when you have a child with a disability, comes with challenges that other parents perhaps don't face. What kind of support is out there for parents, and where do you turn if you need help?
So I guess when Grace was first diagnosed, the immediate support that I had was through Children's Hospital, which, quite frankly, we're really fortunate living here to have such a great Children's Hospital. So that was a lot. You know, as Kara mentioned earlier, you don't want to forget the medical support, because whether you like it or not, it is a part of your life, and it needs to be a part of your life, and it's important to build really great relationships with your medical team. So that was probably my first area of support. And then we went through the whole early intervention realm, as Tim mentioned earlier. And that provides you with not only some great support on helping your child develop, like helping them to mimic motor skills that they might not be doing, but yet the brain needs to wire that way, so you mimic the skills. And I mean, it's a great learning process for parent and child, quite frankly. It's probably more important for the parent. And of course, you connect with other parents through that if you do something in-house, let's say, versus having someone come to your house. If you do something like on-site at Children's versus having people come to your house is what I mean. So that becomes a little bit of a support group, and that also becomes access to other things in the community. So the early intervention team will tell you, well, you know, there's this group or there's this resource, and that's a great way to do it. And then, of course, if you do have a diagnosis, you can learn from, usually there's a website or a local organization connected with that, and you can learn that way about resources. And once you're in school, once you hit that point where ADA comes into effect and IEPs, individualized education plans, come into effect, all of that is there too. So you've got all these great resources for getting you skills to get to school, skills to develop your brain when you're a young child, et cetera. I think what starts to happen is that at that point, parents can, you know, you get very reliant on that. But then your child, as your child gets older, either that becomes less important to your child's development, or your child wishes for that to be less important to their development. And you need other avenues. You might need social avenues, or you just need other avenues. And I think that area is where we're starting to see probably more more work being done, because I know Tim has used this analogy before. The service, if you, you know, use your right arm and your left arm, your right arm being the service, the services that are provided to your child for their development to meet their educational needs and so forth. There's a ton of that available. When it comes to social integration or preventing social isolation, that can be a little bit harder to find. There are certainly things that are available. My daughter can go to MDA camp every summer and be with kids who experience a form of muscular dystrophy. She can go to some of the events that they have. But finding events that allow her to be just a typical kid, if you will, out in the mainstream population, that's a little bit harder to do.
We just had a call from Bobby. She had a bad cell phone, so she had to hang up, but apparently she has two sons. They're 25 and 33 with Asperger's, and she says she got them involved in sports, and that formed many good friendships for them through the Cincinnati Recreation Department. So that's an example of one thing that some folks might do. Let's talk about the whole idea of we said we wanted to talk about the stress of parenting in this situation. And as we said, all situations can be difficult. Do you find that you have different joys with a child in that regard than you might with a disability than a child that doesn't? Or is it just parenting?
My opinion is that it's just parenting. Certainly, you know, if you talk to my son and daughter, they probably have a different perspective. My son probably thinks that we are overly joyous at little things for my daughter, and my daughter thinks she gets probably the negative attention of going to appointments, and Ben, we're going to, you know, something that seems more thrilling. So, you know, my children would have a different perspective than I would have probably, but I think that it's pretty much parenting. I'm not going to say that I do feel like I have worries that other parents don't have. Like, I can say that I have worries for my son that I know he will control and manage. I have worries for my daughter, who does experience disability, because she won't have control over some of these things. And she will be I do want to say at the mercy, but that sounds more tragic than I want it to sound. But she will be, because she also has some cognitive issues, she will be very dependent upon some people making decisions for her that she might not otherwise make herself. So I do worry about those things. I know that my son will go to college. He'll be an income earner. You know, all the things along those lines that you might worry about what career path they take, or whether it's going to take them 4 years or 6 years to get through college. On the other hand, my future worries for Grace are, you know, will she be employable? Will she have friends? Will she have people who live near her who will like her enough to check on her?
Dr. Ayers, why don't you jump in here, and what's your perspective on this?
My perspective is a little bit different, because I do see specific joy in my own identity, but also and not to say that there aren't worries, as Kathleen was mentioning it, and that it doesn't fall under the realm of kind of those typical parenting worries that almost get magnified in many different ways. But, you know, I think it's important to know that there are so many opportunities out there for a range of different people in terms of, you know, increasingly there are more college programs that are opening up for individuals with intellectual disabilities that had expressed an interest and a need for higher education. And so in our area, even, you know, there are programs that are offering. I guess also just from a personal perspective, there are certain things that I don't think I take for granted as much as, because I am aware of how difficult it is for our community to achieve these things. So I'm sure, you know, had I been an adult without a disability, I obviously, you know, would have been happy to purchase my own home with my husband. But for us, we know that the likelihood of a dual disability household purchasing a home is somewhere upwards of 90% of individuals where both people don't have a disability almost never own a home. So when you learn about kind of the numbers behind disability, I think the way that I view it is that these victories are a huge celebration. You know, I know how difficult it is for transportation, especially in Cincinnati, for people with disabilities. You know, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to drive. So, I mean, there are still days that going to my car, I think, gosh, you know, I'm so thankful that I can drive and I can get to my own places when I need to. So I do see the joys, you know, but I also don't forget about the other side of those worries, which is what pushes me in terms of advocacy and making sure that people are aware of the opportunities that are out there. And, you know, and not being, as you know, Kathleen, when we were struggling around that word, not at the mercy of, just, you know, advocacy and self-advocacy is so critical to teach at an early age. And so it's really something that you've got to teach to kids with disabilities and adolescents with disabilities so that they can transition to all those adult outcomes, you know, and have their choices and their voices to make those calls.
We're talking today about the challenges and joys of raising children with special needs. We're going to take a short break. When we continue our discussion, we'll talk a little bit about how parents can prepare for when they're no longer there to help their children. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about raising children with special needs. My guests are Advocacy and Dissemination Coordinator for the University of Cincinnati University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, Dr. Kara Ayer. She's joining us on the phone. Executive Director of Starfire, Tim Vogt, and Starfire Board Member Kathleen Kale. You can join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you. 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Louisa joins us now on the line. Good afternoon, Louise.
Hi, thank you all for your time today.
Yes, what's your question?
So my question is, what organizations are out there that ensure your child's well-being insofar as caretaking is concerned when the parents have passed? And also with the factor of those with financial restraint, because you hear a lot of trite answers when you have the money, but you don't hear any solutions when you're financially constrained because of your special needs children. And are there any groups that monitor their well-being after you pass so you can trust in those groups to keep an eye on your children? And then last I'd like to say is I have two special needs children, and so I think a lot of people, when they have two children, they will depend on their other child to take care of their the one with special needs. But in my circumstance, I may not have that option. And I thank you again for your time, and I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Louise, thank you. Tim, do you want to address that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there are a couple different organizations. Locally, you can check out the Good Life Networks, which is a group of families who are getting together to think about that question, what happens to my kid after I'm gone? And there are probably some others that don't come to mind because it's a big question that's not really being addressed. But I would have to qualify that with saying that other than say friends and family, there is no guarantee that after you're gone, some organization will be able to just look after your child and for the rest of their lives. It's just not a guarantee. There's a lot of examples of organizations that really intend to do that and don't after a few years.
So what happens to these to these people if their parents are no longer there to care for them and there's nothing set up? What happens to them?
Well, most people do have some really great services, say through the Hamilton County Disability Services, and they will get into, say, an apartment or a group home, and for the most part, those places really do a really great job. But if you're asking for 100% guarantee of safety, there's just no way to do that. Now, that's why we keep going back to citizens. We were talking about advocacy a minute ago, and we really believe that if your question, Maryam, was what can citizens do? How can they get involved? And I think that Kathleen is a really great example of what citizens could do, because disability, quote unquote, did not enter her life until, 14 years ago. So she has learned what a citizen could do. And that's the beauty of families. That's the power of families, is they are active models for how to help a person with a disability live a good life. You don't have any problems with Grace eating dinner with you, and you don't have any problems with her living upstairs from you, right? So they are great models of that. And I think the more that we can invite citizens into that story, the better off it'll be in the long run.
I do think from the caller's perspective, we're only now starting to really investigate what the future holds beyond us. Not that we haven't given it some thought. Certainly we have set up certain things for Grace in the event that we die, and whatever we have left, will go into a trust that she can access. And you have to set that up with a lawyer. And then you have to also designate a couple of people to oversee that. And usually it's recommended that you have somebody who's very neutral and then who can kind of manage the money aspect, whatever is left. And a lot of people think, I have nothing. But you do need to remember that no matter what you have, it is something. And if you're leaving it to your children, you want to make sure that you have addressed any legal issue that a special needs lawyer can speak to. And there are lawyers who do this work. So that would be the first thing that I would check out. A lot of people think, I have nothing, but it's not a matter of how much you have, it's whatever you have. And you need to make sure that you're doing as best a job you can to protect that so that it is available to your children and it doesn't end up going elsewhere. The other thing that I would recommend too is that you do, no matter what, as Tim said, there's no guarantee. You could be in the best group home that exists. You could be in the best mixed community that exists. But ultimately, people are paid to look out for your child, and that's a different relationship than a family member or friend has with your child. And if you can find somebody who you are close to, who you know is going to be able to oversee some things, I would strongly suggest engaging that person in your children's lives, because they're the only ones who are going to really look out for your child from kind of the heart and soul that you as a parent want your child to be watched over, versus somebody who's being paid to come in and take care of your child. And unfortunately, in a lot of those cases, it's not the extreme story that you hear on the news that is the problem. It's the day-to-day quality of life, living a fulfilling and satisfying life, that you want to make sure that those paid providers are attending to as well. You don't want your child being taken somewhere and left in a corner because the paid provider is busy texting to a friend or a spouse or what have you. So it's really important to find that friend or family member who's going to have the same love, affection, and care for your child that you have if you're not there.
Let's talk a little bit about, I'm sorry, Dr. Ayers, go ahead.
Can I jump in just real quick? I also wanted to mention, Kathleen brought up the special needs trust, and just because one of the things we do here is keep kind of a pulse on advocacy efforts and different legislation that's being proposed. And one that I would encourage the caller to check out is called the ABLE Act. It's Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, and it was put forth because of the unfortunate situation of where parents were setting up special needs trusts and, you know, leaving financial security, even if, as Kathleen mentioned, even if it was a smaller amount, and even smaller amounts left directly to the individual with a disability can sometimes disqualify them from medical benefits or other disability-related benefits. So it was really a significant problem in terms of how do you leave, you know, the money to the individual without disqualifying them for services. So I know we're closely following the ABLE Act, and we hope that that's something that would allow, it would be a tax-free savings plan for families, similar to what college investment savings plans have been, that would allow people to put away money for their son or daughter that had a developmental disability and that could be used in their future and prior to the event of their parents passing as well. And I wanted to add one other quick, more of like a short term. It sparked my mind when Kathleen said, you know, the challenge of finding a caregiver. And I know on our USED page, it's UCED.org. We also have some respite resources to talk about how to connect families to respite providers because that's extremely needed too among these families, not only just in terms of needing a break and needing self-care, just as all parents do, but the challenge of finding good respite providers.
And Kara,
one that everybody faces.
Could I ask you too? I want to say that I went to a conference and some people from Children spoke about the various waivers that are available and that Children's actually has information for families, and there's a group that can help families go through like the waiver process. So if this caller is unfamiliar with that, and those are not all income-based, some of them are, but, you know, there's a lot of information, I think, maybe that Children's has to address some of the financial issues that might be out there. And then there are, of course, people in the community. I think there are certainly law firms that do that, and they can give you some information on how to handle those things. But if you can speak to that, Kara, I'm not sure if it's your group or not.
You may be speaking, if it was in October, I know Amy Clausen, who is our family support coordinator, she arranged a Be Empowered conference in collaboration with some other local organizations. I know the Parent Group Collaborative was one of those, and she is kind of our resident respite expert here. And so I know that waivers are so tricky because they vary so greatly county by county, so it's impossible kind of to give like universal recommendations, but you could definitely get in touch with our USED here, and specifically I would probably connect you to Amy, who could give you a good idea of who to reach out to with the waivers and get the best information targeted toward where you live. But you're exactly right. There are some that are not income-based, and a lot of people aren't aware that you can apply waivers to things like respite.
What about the role of siblings? And the caller brought that up, too, in the situation that both of his children have disabilities. But do you find that the parents tend to rely on a sibling that does not have special needs to take care when they're gone of the child with special needs? Tim, maybe you can speak to that a little bit if you've witnessed that at all.
I've witnessed that. I mean, parents definitely are conflicted in that. It was funny. I was listening to a father of a young man with a disability talk to a sister of a young man with a disability. They weren't related themselves, but the dad said, I think it's going to fall on our other kids. And the sister said, wait a minute. She said, when did disability enter your life? And he said, I was 27. And she said, so it's always been in my life, and I'm 27 now, right? So I think that there's this interesting tension, which is, oh, I remember a time when I didn't have to look out for the safety of another person. I remember a time when I didn't have to really, really fight to make sure that they were welcome. And I remember a time when, I really was able to ensure that everybody in my family was happy and I didn't have to stand up to prejudice, right? And so, to a certain degree, I've heard parents long for some of those days when they can get back to that. And unfortunately, because of the way the world sees disability, that they struggle getting there. But the sister, she saw it in a different way. She just saw this as the rhythm of my life is this, right? I don't think that everybody's experience is that, but
yeah, I think it does vary. I think that we face that similar situation. My daughter has one sibling, her older brother, and, you know, they're both young. My son is 17. He's looking at his future now, and he's looking at college and so forth. And I'm sure, I know that he's questioning what his role is going to be with his sister, and he's questioning it from the purview of a 17-year-old who wants to go out and enjoy the world and then wonders what that means if mom and dad aren't here. And it's a really tricky, I don't have the answer, I guess, is what I would say. I think it varies from family to family. Is it my hope that my son will be there for his sister and be a great big brother to her and look out for her whenever he can? It's absolutely my hope that that's the case. And it's my hope that whatever relationship we have now is kind of the foundation for something wonderful in the future. But I've spoken to families who've said, I know the siblings aren't going to be able to take care of my child, so I have to make other arrangements. So I think it's a mix for families.
Dr. Ayers, do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think it's important, too, to remember that there are supports out there for siblings specifically, just as there are for parents. And some of these kind of larger family support groups, too, offer that within. And a lot of families aren't aware of that. And there are even national organizations where I know several of the students in our LIND program here, which is our interdisciplinary training program, are siblings of people with disabilities, and in many ways they credit that life experience as what led them in the direction of, you know, pursuing occupational therapy or physical therapy or psychology, and they have that richness of life experience already at the start of their career that they bring. And so I think, you know, it's also important to remember that there's support for siblings and that those are also available, and I hope that parents also recognize the needs of siblings and can connect them to those supports.
With fear of asking a question with only about a minute and a half left to talk, and it's a pretty big question, we'll do our best with it. What about the role that it plays on marriages? I mean, is this a strain on a marriage in cases if you're dealing with a child with disabilities or not?
Well, I'll jump in real quickly from a research perspective. I think it's definitely challenging. There are stresses, and the research tells us that the everyday kind of hassles or stresses are far more challenging than the larger issues that people assume. But the research also tells us that we previously assumed there was this astronomical divorce rate related to having a child with a disability. And when we pick apart those numbers, that's not actually the case. So, it compares to our culture's already high divorce rate. So we need to, you know, also recognize the resilience that in some couples it brings people closer without, you know, not validating the stresses that are there too.
Yeah, I think I don't know that it's that more stressful than some of the decisions and challenges you face in general in life. I do think, though, that if you have an issue in your marriage, this certainly challenges that marriage even more. So I think maybe some of the preconceived notion of high divorce might have been teasing out the people who probably had problems to begin with.
Thank you all so much. I want to let everybody know that on our website you can find links to all of your organizations and some other places to go for more information as well. That's WVXU.org. Just go to the Cincinnati Edition page. I've been talking today about advocacy and advocacy and dissemination coordinator for the UC University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, Dr. Kara Ayers, executive director of Starfire, Tim Vogt, and Starfire board member Kathleen Kale. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Mary Ann Zalesnik.